Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Teacher Preparation Accountability Bill conference call. My name is Karis, and I will be your coordinator for today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If at any time during the call you require operator assistance, feel free to press star zero, and an operator will be more than happy to assist you. At this time, I would now like to hand the call over to your host for today, Ms. Kathy Hepta, Deputy Chancellor for Educator Quality. Please proceed.
Thanks very much, operator, and good afternoon, everyone. We appreciate very much the opportunity to have a call with everybody out there in teacher preparation. I'm here with Eileen McDaniel and her teacher preparation unit at the Department of Education. And the way we've constructed the call today, it is an operator-assisted call because we know a number of you will probably want to ask questions, and we want to make sure everybody can get their questions heard. We did receive questions ahead of time from a couple of folks. I'm going to try to address those as much as I can as I go through the bill. And then if I haven't addressed them sufficiently, then please ask them again when the operator opens the call up for question and answer. And with that, what I would like to do is provide an overview of House Bill 863 before we go into questions. And House Bill 863 is sponsored by Representative Spano, and we're grateful for that. Some of you may remember, and some of you have participated in the Teacher and Leader Preparation Implementation Committee, the TLPIC proceedings, since the beginning of Race to the Top, and know that one of the charges of the TLPIC was to make recommendations to the commissioner regarding a new way and some new process for continued approval, including continued approval standards and even performance targets, and also a review of the uniform core curriculum. And the TLPIC did a large amount of that work prior to September 20th of last year, and provided the commissioner, then Commissioner Pam Stewart, with recommendations on how to look at those two specific areas, and some recommendations on field experiences and things like that. After that time, the State Board of Education took up changes to teacher preparation programs as one of their legislative priorities. And that caused us to then work with elected officials and staff on the education committees, the governor's office, and work with them on the state board priorities. And there were a number of state board priorities adopted, but teacher preparation was one of them. And the state board, in their explanation of their priorities, indicated some of the same things that were recommended by the TLPIC. One thing I want to make clear is that the resulting bill that Representative Spano has sponsored is the only one that we've worked with staff and elected officials on behalf of the State Board of Education. There are a number of bills that have been filed so far this legislative session, and there could be more to come, that deal with requirements for teacher preparation or school leader preparation, but those bills are not related to House Bill 863. And there is no companion bill for House Bill 863 yet, although we do expect one sometime soon. So one of the things that we can provide to the deans and FACTA members would be, when that companion bill is filed, letting you know what the bill number is and who the sponsor is, so you can identify it among all the others that might be filed on this same different topic, but that might have different information in them. The other thing I want to be clear on is, because this became a State Board of Education priority, although you will be able to see that we owe a great deal of debt to the Teacher and Leader Preparation Implementation Committee for the great recommendations they made, and you can identify those very easily in this bill, it does also include other information that was requested on behalf of the State Board of Education. So, this is not a TLPIC bill, but it does absolutely reflect the recommendations that TLTIC made, in addition to other recommendations. So what I would like to do is I go through the bill with everybody today, and I'm going to do this rundown on the premise that you have a copy of the bill in front of you. So I'll be giving line numbers and page numbers, so if you're following along, you can tell where I am. So as I go through that, I'm going to try to point out where where parts of the bill are related to recommendations by the TLPIC, and where they may differ from those, or maybe something completely new that wasn't discussed by the TLPIC. So with that, beginning on page 2, which is section 1 of the bill does deal with all of our different types of teacher preparation programs, all of our approved programs. So we'll have information here that relates to initial teacher preparation programs, which is what the first thing in the bill, because it takes the statutes that are modified in numerical order. And we'll also have a portion of the bill that relates to educator preparation institutes, and a portion of the bill that relates to district alternative certification programs. So section 1 begins with initial teacher preparation programs and modifies section 1004.04 Florida statutes. Some of the information on page 2 that you will also see that we had to do, especially in section 1004.04, is we had to do some cleanup while we were in there. We recommended changes, many of which were included in Representative Spano's bill, because 1004.04 has been around for a long time, for many, many years, and there were portions of it that were redundant and sometimes repetitive, sometimes conflicting lists of things that teachers should do in teacher preparation programs from one another. And so we tried to suggest changes that would clean up and simplify section 1004.04 a little bit as well. And you see some of those on page 2. We've changed looking at graduates to program completers, because there are approved programs that don't terminate in a degree. Changing words like skilled to effective and things like that. When you go to page 3, you'll see the first main section that would reflect some recommendations of the Teacher and Leader Preparation Implementation Committee, and that's recommendations to the Uniform Core Curricula. What we did in our recommendations were in modifying this section, to place the TLPIC recommendations into law and also make this the section that provided information about what candidates would need to do before they completed a program. And so you see the suggested change to the title of the subsection, Uniform Core Curricula and Candidate Assessment. So when you look at lines 67 to 77, you can see that's the bulk of the Uniform Core Curriculum right there that the TLPIC recommended. And you'll see that same set of 6 things in each of the other programs as well, so that everybody has the same Uniform Core Curriculum, whether you're completing an ITP, an EPI, or a VACP. The next thing you see on the bottom of page 3 is, and you can see that's an example of what I was talking about earlier, we had to clean up some language. Then if we have the Uniform Core Curriculum listed above that, then all of the other kinds of things that might have been repeats of things that were already in the Educator Accomplished Practices or something else, then we deleted that language because it's represented on lines 70 to 77 already. When you go to page 4, at lines 85 to 94, then you have the remainder of what the candidate expectations are before program completion. 85 to 87 codifies what we already do in teacher preparation, which is instruction and assessment on the Uniform Core Curriculum and coursework and field experiences. And then 88 to 94 puts in law the same thing we've had in rules since 2006, which is a requirement that each candidate would demonstrate his or her ability to positively impact student learning growth before they finish the program, and then pass all 3 portions of the teacher certification examination series. And so when you see below that language from 95 to 112 that's stricken, then that's again going to be language that would have been repetitive and no longer necessary since we have all the candidate information now in section 2. Going to page 5 in subsection 3, in each of the program types, We deal with initial program approval and continued program approval. So this is the section that deals with initial program approval. And what you see at the bottom in lines 38 to 40 is essentially a statement that we are looking for, and this would have to be explained further through modifications to Rule 6A-5.066, which currently has the detail about initial and continued program approval. We would still expect the detail to be in that rule, and you can see we're going to say a number of times as we go through this legislation that the State Board needs to write rules to explain thus and so. What we've asked for here is essentially for initial approval that the institution and the program demonstrate the capacity to actually implement a program that has the requirements of subsections 2 and 3 in it. And there you see on the top of page 6 the requirements to have those things in State Board of Education rule. On lines 143 through 163, not a lot of modification was done there. TLPIC did discuss grade point average and entrance requirements, but really didn't make a recommendation to change the minimum GPA or the required GPA to enter a program. There was a lot of discussion about that, and there is lots of discussion about that out there across the country. All we did, because there were some institutions that we know wanted to be able to raise the GPA, others did not, that we just added, requested that they add language to say, on line 145, at a minimum, so that an institution would clearly know, although you could anyway, would clearly know that if they wanted to require something greater than a 2.5 for entrance, that would be fine. The general knowledge recommendations on 155 to 163, some of that is just clarification and using more modern terminology, and the rest of it is a recommendation that came from a TLPIC discussion about graduate programs, because we had trouble with the, some of you may remember when the GRE changed its scoring system and all those kinds of things, we had a hard time having a basis for an examination for acceptance into a master's level initial teacher preparation program. So the recommendation was to let the baccalaureate degree stand as the entrance requirement for a graduate level program. And then, of course, everyone still has to pass all three portions of the certification test prior to program completion. So if we move over to page 7, we had questions about the 10% waiver, and which begins in the bottom of page 6, line 165. We did not eliminate the 10% waiver. There was discussion about whether to do that or not. Is it still used? And we know it is still used in some locations. And so rather than eliminate it, we've just requested that institutions report on the status of those candidates. It doesn't really define status in law. It just says that we are expecting institutions to probably through the ICUP, let the department know how those candidates are doing. Specifically how they're doing would certainly have to be in rule, defined in rule. And we'll work through that process like we do with the other requirements for initial and continued approval and annual reporting. So moving on down that page, page 7, then we go to continued program approval. This is where, again, you'll see the set of recommendations from the Teacher and Leader Preparation Implementation Committee as to the actual types of data that would be looked at for performance for continued approval, moving us from a process of looking at or an approval process that looks only at institution processes and program processes and documents into actual performance standards. And this is set up so that we have captured the six areas the TLPIC recommended, six content areas, which you see beginning on lines 192 and going on to the next page. And then the detail about that, the performance targets for each one of those would actually have to be set through State Board of Education rules. So there'll be a great deal of public and teacher educator input on what those performance targets would be, and certainly TLPIC is working on making their own recommendations for those performance targets, too. So that section that begins on line 192, those six things will be repeated again, just like the Uniform Core Curriculum is, when we get to EPIs and when we get to district alternative certification programs. Online 200 through, or 197 through 208, that finishes up the recommendations for the areas that would be included in program approval. Again, you'll notice there's not as much detail in here in the law as TLPIC put in their letter to the commissioner. Some of that detail would be more appropriate for a State Board of Education rule. But we wanted to make sure we had the six content areas in the law. Then you can see there's some, again, some redundant or no longer necessary language in the bottom of page 8 that we could then request that they delete for cleanup. On line 225 on the top of page 9, you see that, again, as I mentioned, the State Board of Education would adopt those performance targets and rule. So we would expect that if legislation passes, this bill as it looks now, or some version of this bill, or a companion bill, would pass during legislative session and get signed into law by the governor, then we would immediately go into rule development for rule 6A5.066 to look at all the aspects that might be affected for initial and continued program approval that need to be modified in that rule. And this would be one of them, to set the performance targets for each of the continued approval criteria. Now, there are also some questions in the next section about the satisfaction survey and whether it's needed or not. There are people that each year, including institutions, that say, yeah, I don't know if we even use this anymore because we don't get a very good return rate. Others do use the information. So what we did was not eliminate it, but allow it to be a permissive requirement that we could, if there are institutions that want us to, and the commissioner decides it's a good thing and we're still getting data from it, that we could do the satisfaction survey for the completers and their employers, or there could be years when we choose not to do it. And that'll be a topic of discussion again when we get to looking at State Board of Education rules. Lines 239 through 242 codify the current process. You'll see a lot of that in here too, codifying the current process, which is the commissioner makes the final decision for continued approval after looking at all the data collected pursuant to this section and new rules of the State Board of Education. If you go to page 10, then the continued approval reporting requirements are discussed in this paragraph C, and then forward. And the first set from 260 down to 275 are about the ITEP. So there is still an ITEP. It's still an annual report. What this is intended to change is what's included in that report, which is now what would be the new continued approval performance areas. And then there's still permission for on line 269 an institution to include additional data as they so choose in their ITEP. If you go to page 11, paragraph D then talks about what the graduate guarantee, as it's sometimes called. The graduate guarantee is still in law. We didn't eliminate it from law, but we did request that we make it more specific and more aligned to what is currently happening. So you can see that on page 12, we've eliminated the list of 1 through 5 items that were or were not, depending on which one you looked at, related to the educator accomplished practices, again, trying to eliminate all the different lists of things and keep that core curriculum intact. And then we also requested on line 301 and 302 to codify again what is the current practice, which is the institution only does this when it's requested by the school district or charter school. On to the next section, page 12, lines 323 and forward. This is the public reporting. As many of you know, there's a public portion to an ITEP and a not public portion to an ITEP. So the portion that would be what the institution reports, again, would be related to the continued approval requirements. And then, just like in the ITEP, lines 334 to 336, an institution can choose to add any other data it wants to its annual report. Page 13 is a lot of language that we were able to request to be deleted since it was a repeat of everything else, and we treat all the programs the same. And on page 14, the annual report, the annual January report, now instead of based on just the satisfaction survey, would now be, this is lines 365 to 376, would now be related to the continued approval requirements. So everything should all be lined up. The IPEP, the annual report that we do, any public reporting that institutions do, although those things can always include additional data, that we'd all have the same core things in all of those reports. When you get to lines 377 and down, this is the section on requirements for pre-service field experiences. The faculty requirements for institutions of higher ed are on page 14, and the school district requirements for the district supervisors of field experiences are on page 15. And we've had several questions about this, so there are a few things that I can clarify as we go through it, and I imagine there'll be other questions later. For the requirements for institution faculty, beginning on line 383, there were three things that were required before, and you could have one of those three things, any one of them. And it didn't really specify which types of field experiences were included in those requirements. So we did a couple of things. The TLPIC actually had recommendations for district employees, which are reflected on page 15, lines 396 to 405. And the State Board of Education determined that, we would also look at requirements for faculty as well, and that we would clarify based on what the TLPIC had said that we're talking about the instructors for what are sometimes called final internships, student teaching, culminating experiences. People use different language. So rather than try to capture all of those different things to separate these experiences from other practical types of experiences that could be just observation or other kinds of practice that are going on with different courses, we chose to use the language from the bill at the beginning to say that it's the experience where the candidate is actually demonstrating his or her impact on student learning. So you can think of these still as whatever you're used to calling them, final internship, student teaching, culminating experience. Any of those things would be equivalent to what we're explaining here. We just described it a little differently, or requested to describe it a little differently based on that impact on student learning requirement. The other thing that's different from what TLPIC recommended, again, they only made recommendations on district faculty requirements, not on institution faculty requirements, is the fact that we changed the or to an and. And essentially, the basis for this is there, and there has been a lot of discussion about which one or ones of these requirements are more important. There are differences of opinion about whether clinical supervision training is the most important, or a teaching certificate matters, or the 3 years of successful teaching experience may matter. We had a good discussion with some folks this morning about whether the experience should be considered relevant or not, and all of those kinds of things. Essentially, our request was to use the language of the law already there to say that it's important for someone supervising the internship or the field experience where actual student learning growth is being demonstrated should be supervised by someone who's done that work and has maintained their current knowledge through whether you demonstrate it through clinical supervision or the experience or the professional teaching certificate, but all those put together would satisfy demonstration that that individual is current on how that works in the schools right now, given the current state of the standards, student content standards, the current educator accomplished practices, district evaluation systems, and all of that information. So our attempt at making sure that these folks that are supervising these kinds of pre-service field experiences, internships, are qualified to do so and have demonstrated that in a way that people can see, would be that they would have all three of these things. Going on to the next section for school district personnel, you can see that in school district personnel, it's the same kind of thing. It's not the teacher who's supervising a practicum course, if it's not where they're going to demonstrate student learning, not a teacher who's agreeing to have a student come observe her class, but it's still related to the field experience where the candidate's demonstrating impact on student learning. So they have all three things. Plus, they have another requirement that they actually were rated effective or highly effective in their previous year's evaluation. So that's one thing beyond what's required for higher ed faculty. Then on line 409, you can see that the pre-service field experience, there's some language there just to clarify that the candidate should be practicing what they've learned in the field experience, specifically on uniform core curriculum in their area of concentration, with a diverse population of students in a variety of settings. And that's language that you'll see in each of the other programs as well. If you go to page 16, that's just some language on lines 425 and 427 that makes it parallel with the previous section. And then 433 until the end of section 1 to 461 is language that is we requested to be deleted, because those are things that just are not in use in teacher preparation programs currently and have not been in some cases for years. 462 is just you'll note there that even though we've said it and the language of the law says it a number of times about the State Board of Education adopting rules, it's said one more time on line 462, that you'll adopt rules to implement the section. Then we go to section 2 of the bill on line 465. This is the section that modifies Educator Preparation Institute. And the first thing you see on line 470 and on line 4 in the section that's modified beginning on 472 all the way over to page 18 through 494 is the option for a private provider to apply to have an Educator Preparation Institute or deliver an Educator Preparation Institute. You may know and you may have seen a number of you have, because you've asked us questions about them, bills that have been filed that have specifically placed providers such as Teach for America into the certification options in 10-12-56. And whereas we know we still don't have enough completers from our own teacher preparation programs, including the district alt-cert programs, to fill all the vacancies every year, so we're open to private providers. It was important for us that the private providers be evaluated on the same basis as any other teacher preparation program. And so since this legislation holds as a premium, making sure that all three program types have the same uniform core curriculum and the same continued approval requirements, those same six things, it made more sense to us to allow private providers the opportunity to apply, which is what you see on 489 to 494, apply to be an Educator Preparation Institute, similar to what we've asked of institutions, which is to demonstrate their ability to offer the program. For private providers, what we had requested is they had actually proven that their performance of their completers was successful based on student achievement, and we had requested in another state that that's how that would be documented before they would be allowed to apply in Florida. The language of from another state did not make it in, but again, this would be something that would go into 6A5.066 as initial approval requirements. And then, if a private provider such as Teach for America or the New Teacher Project or others that operate in other states were approved to deliver an Ed Prep Institute on their own, then they would still be required for continued approval to demonstrate the same six things everybody else is. So that's what that section means. One of the things that you'll see also in the EPI section and in the DACP section, the District Alt-Cert section, is the change from the use of the word alternative to competency-based. In each of these programs, it's not that everybody doesn't use competencies, everybody uses competencies. trying to find some way to do what the state board requested of us years ago, which is to not call everything else an alternative. But they're all approved programs. They all have differences, but we're now going to hold them all to the same continued approval standards. So that's what you see on line 496, and you'll see that throughout for consistency purposes. So if you go to page 19, then you'll start to see some of the substantive changes to educator preparation institutes. One of the differences in the past of EPIs and DACPs from initial teacher prep programs is they were not completed in a subject, at least not in a subject that was captured in any kind of uniform way. So in both the EPI section and in the DACP section, you'll see that we ask that they change the subject matter, the subject area that the candidate's completing the program in be captured. In the case of the EPI, it hangs on the educational plan. One of the things you see first on lines 510 to 517 is, again, that same language we saw in the initial teacher prep, the institute's capacity to implement a competency-based program is required for initial approval. And then lines 519 down to 530 capture the uniform core curriculum in 519 to 525. And then 526 talks about that educational plan. It's referred to earlier in the statute that each participant has to have his or her own educational plan. And that educational plan now would have to declare the subject area that the participant's completing in the program. And that's known as the subject area in which the participant is seeking certification. So that has to be cleared in the educational plan, and that's the area that we're going to capture as far as data reporting goes for educator preparation institutes. Again, you know, we will have to work with all the institutions that offer EPIs, how that information will be reported to us in a uniform way, but this law would require that it is now reported. If you go to page 20, line 539, then you'll see the field experience language again that you saw in the previous section. Field experience is appropriate to the certification subject specified in the educational plan with a diverse population of students in a variety of settings. That's the content, that part of the content of the program. Then when you get to line 549, you'll see what, similar to the previous section, what the participants must do. They have to meet certification requirements, as they always have, by obtaining their statement of eligibility, but now it says in the certification area of the educational plan. The next thing they have to do is the coursework and field experiences, just like in the initial teacher prep program. And then before completing the program, they have to fully demonstrate their ability to teach the subject on they're seeking certification for, and document the positive impact on student learning growth in a pre-K-12 setting, and then by achieving the passing score on all three portions of the teacher certification exam. So that's a change for EPIs. In the past, EPIs just had to pass the professional education portion of the teacher certification exam, but now, just like initial teacher prep, they'll pass all three of those, and then these folks will also be ready for a professional certificate in a specific subject when they complete the program. There's at the bottom of page 21, line 587, there are the continued approval requirements, as you would expect, which is based upon approval by the Commissioner of Education. And then when you turn to page 22, you can see those same six things that are required of initial teacher prep programs for continued approval would be required for ed prep institutes for continued approval. When you go to page 23, you see that the instructors and supervisors of field experiences and EPI refer to the same qualifications as in 10.04.04 for N5 that we just reviewed for initial teacher prep programs. So, whenever they change in 10.04.04, because this language points at that same section. They would also change for Ed Prep Institute instructors of those same kinds of field experiences. It's the field experience where they demonstrate impact on student learning. If you go down a little further, you'll notice in line 634 to 638 that just like an initial teacher prep program, could modify the rules, State Board of Education rules, to include the performance targets for continued approval. And, you know, that's rule 685.066. Now, the third section has to do with qualifications of personnel, and this is not a specific recommendation that we had requested, but it has to do with fingerprinting and background screening for these individuals. If you go to section 4 on the bottom of page 24, this is where we're going to talk about the district alternative certification programs. And the first thing you see on page 25 is actually something not related to alternative certification programs, but related to certification, and it's specifically to assist military personnel. On line 686 through 690, this is language that the State Board has tried to get passed in previous bills for a number of years, but we can't seem to get it into a bill that actually gets signed into law. So we're hopeful about this one. And it is to use for certification purposes a transcript received by the American Council on Education. The ACE folks, which are made up of it's a board primarily of higher education folks and others, they're the ones that work on making recommendations for college credit equivalencies based on experience and other things. And military folks in the military use ACE transcripts a lot. What has had to happen in the past without this sentence is that the individual who exits the military, they have credits that are shown in an ACE transcript, and they go to enroll in an accredited institution of higher education. And some of those credits are accepted on the transcript. Others are not. A lot of times, the ones that are not are only based on the number of credits that the institution allows to be accepted. Sometimes they have a minimum of 9 or 12 or 6, depending on the institution and the program that individual's enrolling in. And it costs a great deal of money to have those shown on an official transcript just so they can look exactly the same and then be used for certification purposes. So in this instance, we're trying to support folks that come out of the military by saying that we can accept an ACE transcript for college credit for purposes of certification without requiring the individual to go to an institution and pay fees to have it shown in that institution's transcript. If you go further down the page, again, you'll start to see some language about competency-based rather than alternative. And then if you go to page 26, then you'll see the portion that begins to modify the district alternative certification program on line 702. We've changed the name to competency-based professional development certification program instead of alternative certification program. And you'll also see on line 705 that the school district may provide this program. Since the inception of these programs in 1999, the original legislation has required every district to have a program. What has happened over the last decade is majority of the districts still operate their program as approved, and they have completers, as you can see, and if you've looked at the TLPIC data, we have providers, district providers in this area that produce a lot of completers and some that produce very few and everything in between. And we have some districts that produce none. The district has the program on the books, but they don't actually have anybody in it because they can't afford to or don't have the capacity to run the program. It's in a small district or something of that nature. So, again, looking to codify what's actually the current practice, this would become a permissive thing for a school district to do. Then we go down further to starting with line 717, and going through, then you're going to start to see the changes that that make the DACPs, the district certification programs, have the same uniform core curriculum and continued approval requirements as do the other two program types. Now, one thing I should explain to you is that, and I should have said this earlier, each one of these statutes is constructed a little differently. And so we didn't rewrite our request that they rewrite everything. We did request that they use the construction that's currently used in the law to minimize some of the changes. So everything in this section is not exactly in the same order as you see it in the other two, and the other two aren't in exactly the same order, but it is the same information. So first thing you see is on line 722, the mentors that are, you can think of these as the supervising faculty. You can see that they're required to have that effective or highly effective rating and hold their valid certificate, which of course they would because they're already teaching in the district, and they would have those same things in the clinical educator training. When you go to line 730 on page 27, this is one thing here that is different for the district programs that's not included in initial teacher prep and not included in EPI because these programs are based in a district. And that is requiring the district to make sure that this program, their certification program, is in fact aligned with their evaluation system. Because what we don't want is we don't want folks that are trained in one set of requirements and then they're evaluated on another set of requirements. So we want those two things aligned. So that's unique to district certification programs. Then you can see that we are looking for, when you go a little further down, they're still required on line 738, as they always have been, to include professional education preparation. And then we go into the specific six things that are in the uniform core curriculum. 740 includes the student content standards, content literacy, mathematical practices for the subject shown on the temporary certificate. So again, we'll be able to capture the subject for a district certification program completer. 744 already had the accomplished practices. 746 already required monitoring student progress. And then 748 through 753, that's where you see added the methodologies for students with disabilities and English language learners. So that rounds out the rest of the uniform core curriculum. On line 759 through 762, you see that they're required also to, just like in other programs, to now complete all certification exams before they're called a program completer. The reason why 761 to 762 reads a little differently is because general knowledge is already required for these program participants because they're employed. It's an employment requirement earlier in 1012.56. And so we just reiterate that employment requirement here to have to pass the general knowledge test. 763 through 770 is really not about the alternative certification program. It's not about the certification program in the district. It's about the district's competence demonstration system, which is still required for every district to have for individuals who are doing the certification requirements one thing at a time. And this is where they're required to demonstrate the accomplished practices in the classroom before they can hold a professional certificate, along with everything else you have to do for certification. And so we just simply modify that again to make sure it's lined up with the FEPS and with the district's evaluation system. 773 takes us back to the district alternative certification program with continued approval requirements. And here again, you're going to see the same thing that you saw for the other two program types, starting with line 780. That repeats each one of these, and then on line 795, we talk about how we're going to work a review of this program into the district's review of its professional development system already conducted in another statute. The last provision in the bill is still in 1012.56, but you see it on 799. It relates to examinations, the certification examinations. This was requested from Phil Canto's area because they've had such issues over the last several years. Things have changed with regard to examinees who request to see their actual examination. What they've had and what they're trying to work on is not to prevent that from happening. We still want to allow people to look at their exams if they've not passed. But they're trying to put some parameters around that because of the fact that they've had a number of individuals who come sit for the exam, fail the exam on purpose, and then request to come review their examination question by question, and then they'll take that information back to another private entity who then will help people prep for the test. So what they've requested here is some language that will allow the state board to put some provisions and some parameters around that examinee review, just so we can have the information we need to prevent that from happening. The last section, section 5, is just to make some language parallel because references changed in the law. And then we have an effective date on line 849 on the last page of July 1, 2013. So at this time, Eileen, do you have any comments before we open it up for questions? Okay, operator, can we invite folks to ask questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your phone. If your question has been answered, you wish to withdraw your question, press star 2. And your first question comes from Lana Gloria Perez with the University of Miami. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, everybody. I just wanted to say thank you to Kathy for going over this bill so carefully and for clarifying the recommendations that were made by the Teacher Leader Preparation Implementation Committee on which I serve. That's all I wanted to say at this time. Thank you.
Thanks, Gloria.
And your next question comes from Lionel Carol Jones, Pascal Hernando. Please proceed.
Hi, Kathy and Eileen. My question goes to page 21, line 564. Initially, when we set up the EPI programs, different colleges had different requirements for completion. Some of them did require the subject area test and general knowledge test. Some of them, like PHCC, only required them to complete the professional educator test. So do we need to change our program now to include the subject area and the general knowledge test as completion requirements?
Thanks for your question. Actually, you don't need to do that now because this is only a proposed bill. But if a bill were to pass and be signed into law that required what you see on lines 563 to 566, then yes, that would be something that institutions with EPIs would have to do.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from line with Julia Vadiato, Broward College. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just a quick question in regards to the requirements for clinical supervisors of our, what we call at Broward College, our student teachers, which is our culminating field experience.
Yes.
I know that the ORs have now become ends for those three areas. Is there any discussion or is that something we can talk about in terms of the rule development for what's going to be required for our individuals? What am I trying to say? For their current certifications, that they have a current certification. Most of our clinical supervisors, if not all of them, are retired teachers or retired school administrators who have allowed their certifications to lapse, so theirs is not current. Would that be something that we would discuss, Kathy and Eileen, in the rule development area as to how their certifications can be either reinstated or how they can be continued?
Thanks. That's a great question. I think there are a couple of forums where that would be discussed. The first one is, as this bill is traveling through its committee stops, there will definitely be a lot of discussion about what's important for those supervising faculty to have, either with credentials or experience. That conversation is being had right now out there across the state. And I think that would be the first thing. And then when we see what actually does get signed into law, then we would go about rule development to say what are those specific things that would implement that part of the law, both for people who are currently supervising and those who might be supervising in the future.
Thank you.
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that is star 1 to ask a question. And your next question comes from Lionel Carol Walker with St. Leo University. Please proceed.
Hi, this is actually Trish Parrish at St. Leo.
Hey, Trish.
So I actually have two questions for you, Kathy. And the first one has to do with the change from or to and. I want to make sure I understood you properly, that this clause as written, and if it's passed as written, only applies to the experience where we're gathering that data, and that any other field experiences where we're not gathering the data on student impact, it does not apply to.
Thanks, Trish. That's a great way to say it. That's exactly right. So if you had an experience that was required for one of your courses where the candidate was just observing, they were doing some practice, but it wasn't where they were going to demonstrate the impact on student learning, then these qualifications would not apply.
Even if it's a formal practicum where they're teaching lessons, but we're not gathering the data to report at that point?
That's right. That's right. And that's the kind of thing that we would have to specify very clearly in the rules, though, because I'm sure people use different terminology and have different requirements for different kinds of field experiences. So it is intended to separate those two kinds of field experiences from each other, but I'm sure we'll have to be really clear with our definitions when it comes to rulemaking on this.
Okay, thank you. And then my second question has to do with the private providers. As written, would this bill then require those private providers to have an EPI status in order for their completers to earn professional certification?
At this point in time, the only way a private provider's candidates or someone who's working with a private provider, like Teach for America, for example, works in Duval and Dade counties right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the law currently permits a district to work with a private provider or other entity in implementing its district certification program, but the district still is responsible for the program. So the private provider can't do that on its own.
Okay, so this would allow TSA to meet the same standard as us?
That's right.
And
on its own.
Okay, thank you. Those were my questions. I appreciate your time today.
Sure, thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Mildred Berry of Florida Memorial University. Please proceed.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks a lot for your explanation.
Hey, Mildred.
I need a clarification on 748, methodologies for teaching students with disabilities. And my question is, does that require a separate course or can it be infused into existing courses?
Sure. Any place that you see the methodologies for teaching students with disabilities, whether you see it in, like you pointed out, in the district certification program or it's in the EPI and the initial teacher prep, but that's part of the uniform core curriculum, it doesn't say that it's a separate course. It just says those methodologies have to be included. So I think we can go about that process through our standards and guidance the way we've done other things in the past.
Okay, thank you.
And your next question comes from one, Dr. Brisser with FAU. Please proceed.
Actually, this is Bob Shockley, Kathy.
Hey, Bob.
One of the big concerns that is being expressed from our institutions is the issue related to the requiring the current teaching certification for our supervisors. I understand the intent, but you and I have had discussions and we're working on problems related to clinical education already in the state of Florida. Many of our institutions are having a great deal of difficulty even in the placement of our student teachers. And now overlaying this with another requirement that not only is going to have a lot of logistical issues when you consider the tremendous number of placements and the supervisors that we're currently using, but also has tremendous cost implications to our institutions and potentially to the individuals that supervise our student teachers. It's my understanding this goes into effect if this law passes July 1. What flexibility, and I know there's been some discussions with Representative Spano, but what flexibility do you think there might be to sit down and try to come up with some language that gives a little more flexibility while meeting the intent of the statute?
I think that's a great point, Bob. And just to reiterate, this is, we don't even have the Senate version of the bill yet filed, and this is early in the process. And I think it would be great to have people talking about what's in here and what is important and what's required. We've had also some questions about whether or not some institutions require clinical educator training for some of their folks too, and that seems to be a hardship for some people. So I think going back to the basis for the qualifications and considering what's happening during that field experience, I think it would be important for institutions to talk about with folks what they think are essential requirements for those individuals and how those could be documented. I think that's a very, very important part of the conversation. So we'd always welcome that.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Claire Torres with UNF. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Kathy, Eileen. Can you speak a little bit more about that annual reporting on candidates that are admitted by exceptions?
Sure. It really doesn't specify much of anything in the statute except that rather than eliminating the 10% waiver, just making sure institutions are working with those candidates, and I think that would be something we'd have to specify in the state board rule. As how institutions are reporting that those candidates' progress.
I do believe that probably needs to be worked on a little bit more in terms of what does it mean, because our candidates do have to show progress in all the competencies, even if they're waivers or not. So I'm just not sure why now this annual reporting in addition to the 10%.
Maybe it's a compromise in eliminating the waiver altogether.
Okay. Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Patricia Green-Powell with SAMU. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. It's Bernadette Kelly from Florida A&M University. I have a question about the PTO. I know we're changing the language from alternative certification to competency-based, but I didn't hear anything about the PTO from the university perspective.
Thanks. That's a great question. The PTO really only lives in rule. It's not a separate program that the statute provides in a separate section of law. It's something that the State Board of Education authorized for programs that already have an initial teacher preparation program to also offer a professional training option. So it's only found in 6A5.066.
And your next question comes from the line of Rebecca Pfeiffer with Florida State University. Please proceed.
I'm sorry, this is Diana Rice from Florida State. My question has to do with the certification area. I am not currently certified, but my original certification was secondary science, and my degree was actually K-12 science. If I'm working in an elementary ed program and teach science methods, does the certification not matching the area in which I'm working, will that be a problem if I am certified?
That's a great question. Actually, this is something we discussed with some other folks this morning, is it doesn't really say, at least in the language that's in front of me, I don't see where it says that the subject of the professional certificate for the supervising faculty has to be in the same area of the internship. It just says to hold a professional certificate.
Okay, thank you very much.
And your next question comes from Laura Gloria Perez with the University of Miami. Please proceed. Gloria, your line is open.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Kathy, hi, this is Gloria Perez again. I just need to understand, to follow up on Trish's excellent question. The holding the faculty has to be certified. Are you saying that if a student is in a practicum course and we're not collecting data, those faculty members do not need to be certified?
The amendments to the in this particular version that you see in front of you try to separate internship field experiences, culminating field experiences from all other kinds of field experiences. That was the discussion you probably remember from TLPIC. But instead of using what, if some people don't call, some people call them student teaching, some people call it final internship, some people call it culminating experience, We chose to use the language saying this is the field experience where you're going to demonstrate impact on student learning, that kind of field experience. And so that's the only place that would be required.
Okay, but I'm still not understanding this quite well.
So if somebody's doing an observation field experience where you're just observing a teacher teach, then...
No, I understand the difference there. What I don't understand is we have students demonstrating impact on student learning growth in several courses, but I don't necessarily have to collect data in all of those. So is that... That's what I understood from your answer to Trish.
Right, I agree. I think that's the issue we're going to have to work out through State Board of Education rule and exactly which courses we're talking about. It is intended to be different from those where you're just observing. But
I understand, but remember, many of us have, if any, very few courses just observing, especially the private institutions. So if it's a matter of collecting data, okay, but if it's a matter of something else, then I'm a little confused now.
Okay, well, that's something we'll need to talk about and keep talking about that.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure.
And your next question comes from the line of Carol Walker with St. Leo University. Please proceed.
Hi, Kathy. This is Candace Roberts from St. Leo.
Hi.
How are you?
Great.
I have a question in reference to line 192, item A. This is in reference to the criteria for continued program approval, and the placement, one of the items is the placement rate of program completers into instructional positions in Florida public schools. And my understanding at one point was the TLTIC had discussion about this and was going to suggest that it be an area of bonus points on the scoring because private institutions, as part of their mission, we reach students from other states and other areas, and those students often go back to their home states after they've finished our programs.
Thanks. Eileen is here. She's going to talk about what the TLTIC discussed. And just keeping in mind that any of those things that are listed there, the actual scoring system would have to be put into State Board of Education rule, but we wanted to make sure those areas were covered. Eileen?
Hi. This is Eileen. This is an area that was not discussed about as being a bonus. That was another area, but there was much discussion about placement rate being a difficult area for some institutions, whether they are public or private, that where this data might not be easily obtained. Of course, the only placement data that we do have for the state that we do gather is for those who are in any public school district in Florida in an instructional position, but it would not be a bonus area. The bonus area was actually the critical shortage area, which was
Critical shortage is the last one.
It's the last one that's listed.
So would there be some consideration when it is written into state rule in reference to the mission of private universities?
I think it wouldn't be taken into consideration, but we would need to define it more clearly for you in rule. And also there's going to be instances where we've been having a great deal of discussion in TLPIC about the rule of 10 and how that might affect the results and how they're reported.
And one other question in reference to that, if our students were placed in private schools, let's say we're a Catholic institution, if we had students who graduated and chose to stay in Florida but went to a Catholic school to teach, would those students be considered being in state?
Thanks. This is Kathy. That's one of the things that we'll have to work on for data collection in the future because right now we just collect data on students that go into public schools, which includes charter schools, but regular public schools. And going back to it, so again, probably we'll need to work on exactly what can be counted and what can be included. And remembering that although a lot of these discussions did take place in TLPIC, one of the things the State Board is interested in is approving institutions that are helping supply needs in Florida. So I think that's a great point you're talking about with private schools, and that's something we can work on.
All right, well, I very much appreciate all of the detailed explanation. Thank you so much. I have one follow-up question. Actually, it's a new question. It's on line 333 in reference to a report to the general public. And I just wanted some clarification on what that report was. Is that a report that's initiated at each individual institution and disseminated to the public in reference to our performance as a continued program, approved program?
Thanks, yes. That's the same report that your institution has been required to do.
Okay, great.
It says by program, but generally they're done by an institution at the institution level.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much.
Sure.
And your next question comes from Lauren Orlick with University of Miami. Please proceed.
Yes, Kathy and Eileen, as a follow-up to the last question from St. Leo, and as a member of the TOPIC, please help me understand, institutions of higher ed do not show a high number of students staying in Florida public or charter schools will not be penalized, correct?
Lori, all of this is going to be worked out through State Board of Education rule, because what is in here right now are the content areas that the standards are going to be set in. So that whole process of what the targets are, what's expected under each of the targets is going to have to be placed in rule rather than in law. And so we're going to have to go through all of that rulemaking with all the input from everybody should something be signed into law. I think, again, just to reiterate, we're all trying to have multiple metrics that we can look at to see how institutions that we're going to put our state approval on are contributing to Florida schools.
Correct.
That's one of the things that we'll have to look at.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from line of Susan Newman with Miami-Dade College. Please proceed.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing us to have this. We have the big problem that Miami-Dade County Public Schools does not like to hire teachers. What they are doing now is they are hiring them as full-time substitutes, and I'm concerned how this is going to impact on our approval.
Thanks. Those folks that Miami-Dade hires, I know they code them as 3300s or something like that. But they're reported to us as teachers of record through our staff database, and that's what we would use to see that somebody is actually working in Dade County Schools as a teacher.
Well, you just all sent out a report to us where a very low number of teachers were hired from the programs in our county. And I know by doing my own follow-up that more than that from our institution were placed and are hired, and so I'm wondering how that's going to work.
Okay, thanks. We'll work through all that data process together to make sure everything is very, very accurate.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Claire Torres with UNF. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Eileen, Kathy. I have a question within the section of continued program approval. It says production of program completers in statewide critical teacher shortage area. And I'm sure this is probably going to be addressed in the rule, but can you speak of what are the expectations? Are we going to have to meet certain thresholds, or are institutions going to be defined what meeting the needs for, I guess, producing these program completers in this area?
Thanks, Claire. The first thing is the State Board does adopt critical shortage areas every year, and they've been largely, the bulk of them, been the same, and they're the same in every other state since time immemorial. There can be some fluctuations in a few different ones that are added or are taken off each year, but the bulk of them are the same. Science, mathematics, exceptional student education, those kinds of things, and English language learners. So you're right, you're absolutely right. This is something that would definitely be part of the State Board rule process to define what the targets are and how an institution would be evaluated on meeting those targets or far exceeding those targets, those kinds of things, because that's something else that the TLPIC has been talking about too, as a group of FACTA for years, having a way for institutions to distinguish themselves. TLPIC is working on a recommendation that the critical shortage areas would be a sort of a bonus area in the accountability system. But again, all those things would, and their work, the great thing about the TLPIC work is you can see all those data and presentations on their site to see what they've been talking about. But that would definitely be something we'd have to work through and rule. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And your next question comes from the line of Jan Yates with Nova Southeastern University. Please proceed.
Hello, everyone. Kathy, my question was just answered.
Okie doke. Very good. Thanks for participating.
And at this time, there are no further questions in queue.
Okay. Thanks very, very much, everybody. I know we'll have continued conversations. We have a FACTA meeting coming up soon and all that. So thanks very, very much for your time today. Eileen, we're done?
Yes. Thank you very much, everyone. We'll be back in touch. This call was recorded. We'll post it on the website as soon as it's available in about a week.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Have a good afternoon. Okay. I'll ready to get on the call.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect. Have a wonderful day.